his battery doesn't owe him anything.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Stu. Yeah, lead acid cells, they're relatively inexpensive. They're well understood. But they don't have the longest, time. And, you know, I think I've mentioned before that I have a bunch of, uninterruptible power supplies, UPSs for my computer systems and my shack and such. And, yeah, every about 3-4 years, I gotta take the old one out and junk it and replace it with a new one. And I basically, it just trickle charges it. I haven't had that many outages to require it. So lead acid batteries have their pluses and they have their minuses.
Boy, I don't know if someone is QRMing you, but it seems every time, most of the times that you come on, the beginning of your dialogue, there's some weird noises and your voice is totally inaudible. So as I said, I don't know if it's QRM, but I've never heard this type of interference on LimeWalk ever until this evening. It's certainly weird.
Okay. I don't know what to tell you. Using my regular radio. I don't know why it's giving the such strange things. One of the many problems is, unfortunately, LimeWalk's Glen Oaks repeater is not really tuned terribly well for good old Brooklyn. So I'm at the outskirts of its ability to receive a signal. Usually I use All-Star, but for some weird reason, the headset that I'm using doesn't want to feed the audio from All-Star. So I decided to go back on to RF as best I can, and over the next week I will try and figure out what the heck's going on with the headset.
I don't think it's your signal. It sounds like someone is QRMing you when you begin to talk.
Okay, well, I mean, that certainly is a possibility. There's more than a few strange people out there with strange motivations. We'll have to handle it as best we can. I hope it doesn't impact on the technical net too much, but, you know, at this point, you know, if it was an hour ago, I would reboot my computer and start to play around with settings, but I don't think that would add too much to the TechNet experience either.
It does sound like QRM, but it sounds like QRM from a distant station.
I'm sure it's just a little atmospheric.
It sounds curious. K-A-T-U-C-S.
Okay.
There's someone with a live feed that's apparently typing in the background, so that's interesting. I don't know what the heck's going on at this point. Okay, I don't understand why, but there's someone typing in the background on the repeater.
Somebody's typing on a keyboard
while we were here.
It's exactly what it sounds like. Somebody's typing.
Yeah, it's kind of like someone has an open connection. He's not aware he has an open connection. He's not talking to himself, so that's a good sign. But, you know, he's doing some browsing or he's doing some computing, and so there's the clickety-clack of a computer keyboard in the background and nothing else. So perhaps that's what's interfering with my transmission. I don't know what method he's getting into the repeater, but apparently there's some guy who isn't aware that he's connected to the repeater right now.
You didn't get any of that. You're totally, I hate to use the expression, stepped on, but you stepped on.
Okay, well, again, I don't know what to tell you. I can't really do much about that. I guess, if you want me to get a migraine listening to myself, I could switch back over to what I have of All-Star.
You would just find that time.
Okay, then I do not have a clue. I assume that it's some guy puttering around with RF. So if I was able to go digitally directly through an All-Star link, that might not be a problem. Who knows?
I think you're fine now.
You're okay, Roy. I think somebody had an open mic accidentally after the other problem. You're doing good.
Okay, these things happen. You know, we all screw up. I'm sure that we've kind of looked at one of our radios and seen it blinking red, and for some odd reason, something triggered the push-to-talk button. So no harm, no foul. Anyway, Rich, so I think we kind of knocked this around a lot. I think the general suggestion is, at the very least, test your battery. At the very most, get ye to a battery replacement store.
Thanks, everybody, for their comments. I'll dig into this further.
Okay, good luck, Rich, and I'm sure you'll let us know how it all turns out.
I will indeed.
What?
Yes.
Well, I'm here in Florida. I've been here since 2005. My car batteries last about 2.5 years. I got 2 cars. I maintain them very well. So the batteries are about normally last 2.5 years, and that's it for the batteries. And you guys are in the all season weather up there, so that's about it. So just have to take out the old piggy bank and just go get a new battery, and you're well on your way. That's enough info.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, I would agree again. They are consistent, but they're short-lived. I mean, I promote for amateur radio lithium iron phosphate. It's much more expensive than lead acid. It allows for a much larger number of recycling, and the lifespan generally is more than twice that of lead acid. And also another characteristic that's not that important for cars but important for other things is that as batteries discharge, their voltage potentials go down. And lithium iron phosphate has a much slower descend as you discharge it than lead acid. As you drop the lead acid from 100% to something like 50%, the voltage potential can plummet. So I'm a big fan of lithium iron phosphate. Apparently, that's kind of the new technology that's going to be used in a lot of electric vehicles. Again, because in addition to all that, it's a little bit less dangerous than lithium ion technology in batteries. They're less likely to explode on you.
PhD.
Yes, Jim.
What?
Yes, Jim.
Take somebody else. I'll follow them.
Okay, the other guy.
Hello, this is KG2RY. Hello, and hope you're having an excellent evening. You talk about the electric cars. I just want to say that recently BMW announced they're giving up on electric car technology. They're going to work on hydrogen.
Well, I mean, the same thing is going on in Japan. I understand that Ford has kind of decreased the production of their electronic vehicles. I think EVs have kind of peaked in the population, unfortunately for guys like Elon, who have their entire life savings invested in it. So it'll be interesting to see how time goes on. We kind of talked about that many episodes of the Technical Net, that, you know, something latches on to the imagination and people kind of go a little wacky about it, and eventually reality kind of shows itself. And it's a self-correcting problem that we have with gee whiz 21st century technology.
Comment?
Yeah, sure.
This is WA2VSM. I totally acknowledge what was said about the transformation, if you will, or beginning of a transformation to hydrogen-powered cars. But does anybody remember the German blimp that blew up in New Jersey with all the hydrogen instead of helium. Hydrogen, although I'm heavily invested in the energy sector, very heavily invested, and I can tell you, it sounds great on paper. However, when hydrogen explodes, I don't want to be around.
Yes, Bill, let me make sure I have it.
Well, gee, think about hydrogen for cars.
David, can I have a chance to say something?
Please.
Okay, well, let me assume that I have the repeater. We talked about hydrogen before. Hydrogen has a bunch of its own problems. One is that to contain it is expensive. It's very light and small, the molecules, and so it kind of bleeds through a lot of things. So storage facilities are problematic, transportation is problematic, infrastructure is problematic. It requires all the things that electric vehicles require as well. We have gas stations all over the place. We have gas tanks storing it and gas trucks transporting it. It's relatively safe, and it doesn't really cost anything to manifest, whereas hydrogen is going to introduce all of these costs. So somewhere down the road, maybe it will be reasonable. And then, of course, you have the problem of where you're getting the hydrogen from. You can break it from fossil fuels, but you still are using fossil fuels. You can break water with electrolysis, but where are you getting the electricity for the electrolysis? That requires, again, coal or fossil fuels. We don't have fusion reactors. We're not going to have fusion reactors anytime soon. So there's all these problems. There are Japanese companies promoting hydrogen as an alternative to electric vehicles, and in Germany as well. I tend to think that what we're going to end up with is a percentage of hybrid cars, some electric vehicles, and mostly gasoline for the foreseeable future. I think people are slowly discovering the problems with electric vehicles, unfortunately.
Thank you, Roy. It's more sense to my electric car topic.
Yeah, isn't it interesting that things lead into other things?
Thank you, Roy. Put me in where you will.
Okay, anyone with any other comments? I mean, you know, we could spend the next 10 hours discussing electronic vehicles, a hydrogen fuel as an alternative, and hybrids versus gasoline, and we may, except that the repeater, I think, still shuts down sometime in the middle of the night. But, you know, it's an important topic for discussion. Again, I think California always takes things a little bit too over the edge, and they did it again by passing laws to make in future non-electric vehicles illegal, which they'll eventually reverse, as they have reversed many similar types of weird laws that they've come up with. So anyone with any other comments on this before we move on, which will actually be moving back to this topic?
Just one other comment from Stu W.A. to the SM boy.
Sure, Stu.
Right now, I mean, I've been involved, as I said, in the energy sector in terms of oil, nat gas, propane, and other fossil fuel derivatives. And I think that natural gas as a fuel for trucks, tractor trailers, buses, and even some of the fleets of big companies has a very, very a good safety profile. And we have more nat gas in the ground than we can ever use. God was good to us. It is a clean burning fuel, much cleaner than coal, much cleaner than oil. The only other fuel that is cleaner than that, of course, is nuclear, excluding the alternatives, which are not reliable. But I think there's going to be a decent time, a runtime, for the use of natural gas to power items. and it's relatively safe. It really is. So I'm a proponent of the nat gas. The only problem we're facing is of a political one, that we're being told that they want to shut down the export of nat gas and not to allow these, I don't know what you call them, but like floating factories that process the nat gas and do this and that. I forgot the term. It's a little late in the evening, but Roy, I truly believe that nat gas is a viable source of energy.
Well, in principle, let me make sure I got the repeater. Okay. In principle, I agree with you, Stu. I think it's certainly viable. The big bugaboo with all the fossil fuels is the carbon footprint aspect. And so people will throw carbon at you left, right, and center. And unfortunately, natural gas is a carbon-based fuel. So you're going to have a carbon footprint. If you notice that the things that are new, shiny, and flashy and promoted all over the place, electric vehicles are not directly carbon footprint. You gotta trace it back a few steps before you get collided with the fact that you're still producing carbon dioxide. And hydrogen gas also is not inherently a carbon footprint unless you're getting the hydrogen gas by using hydrocarbons in some way. So I think that's the problem, that people promoting EVs and hydrogen sources, they're looking more at the carbon footprint.
Well, I read trade magazines every day. This is part of what I do. And I could tell you with 100% certainty that we have the cleanest natural gas usage anywhere in the world. And we work on that every single day. This is what all the trades indicate. And in terms of sources of hydrogen, as you pointed out, you can break down water seawater to hydrogen and oxygen. That's the H2O. But it takes electricity, as you mentioned. And furthermore, all these EV cars, you need a decent amount of electric current to charge these EV cars. So people have to stop playing with themselves and thinking that, oh, the carbon footprint is less, but you're not charging these cars with chopped liver. It takes energy to charge these batteries. These are massive batteries, Lloyd. So, you can't listen to these naysayers, these dummies, who tell you, if we don't eliminate carbon fuel sources in 8 years, the world will die, as we were told, I think, 8 years ago, or whatever the years was, your determination was. There's a lot of hype to this, and it's mostly crap.
Well, I would sooner leave the discussion of global warming to the political net that's on after midnight than here on the technical net. The problem is that a lot of people are very easily snowed as far as carbon footprint applies to electric vehicles and to hydrogen-run equipment, because usually they don't bring out the fact that fossil fuels are needed to create the charge in the batteries and the hydrogen in the hydrogen-run vehicles. And the general population is not that focused. They don't listen well. And a lot of them, it's totally lost on them, unfortunately. So the ability to just say that there's no immediate carbon imprint has a big imprint on voters and investors and all kinds of people. So although you and I may understand the underlying flaws of the concept, that doesn't stop people from promoting it in spite of these flaws.
Yeah, the people in Hollywood who say, I drive a Prius, and then they get into their Learjet and dump a zillion tons of carbon, these are the hypocrites. And I'm not getting into politics. We're just talking economics, if you will. So there's a lot of crap to that. And all these people who have great notoriety and are pushing climate change, like John Kerry, who's a multi-gazillionaire, they get into their jets, their Learjets or what have you, and will bombardier and they fly all over the world and they pollute dramatically. But these are the same people who are pushing climate change. We need to go to alternative fuels. I want to see a windmill sitting on the top of their jet aircraft. See how far that will get them.
What can I tell you, Stu? Hypocrites are all over the place. They're all political colors, shapes, and sizes. There are rich hypocrites. There are poor hypocrites. There are Democratic hypocrites. There are Republican hypocrites. If there's one thing constant in the universe, it's hypocrisy. So unless you have some kind of psychological method to rid ourselves of hypocrites, I think we just have to live knowledgeable that such people exist among us.
I could not have said that.
Contact.
Sorry, Jim, I doubled for a second. Roy, I could not have said that better. Thank you.
You're welcome. Jim, you wanted to say something?
I do. I'd like to take this back to the technical, if you will, on this very topic. I think it's an excellent topic. I think I have some things to share.
Yes, I would love to. A matter of fact, this probably bleeds right into one of your questions for tonight, so please feel free.
So natural gas is an amazing thing. Most people don't really differentiate it from propane like you use in your barbecue, but it's very different. It's very different. From my experience and my training in the fire service, you get to know these things and learn a lot about them and how they work in the real world. When things go bad. So it's interesting that propane, you can pressurize it and stick it into a barbecue tank and put it in your car. You're not supposed to put it in the trunk. You're supposed to put it in some place where you can smell it in the penetrating compartment. Drive it home and run your barbecue. New York City, that all gets really weird because, we'll have to do much there. But that's what we do. We take a 20-pound barbecue tank, go fill it up. It's not refrigerated, it's just pressurized. Propane, if you let it out in the atmosphere, is a gas. If you pressurize it, it becomes a liquid. And it's very convenient. And what's nice about it is it lasts forever. It has no shelf life. It doesn't go bad. Gasoline in a can will go bad. Propane does not. Useful for emergencies and stuff like that. I'm going to let it drop a second. I'm going to switch over to natural gas.
Jim, don't forget the fact that propane gas is not terribly useful when the ambient temperature drops. Remember that.
I don't have to remember that. I'm actually in my shack right now with a propane tank that won't heat me up because it's too cold outside for the little bit of propane to vaporize properly. You're absolutely right. So, back to the natural gas. Natural gas is interesting because it doesn't want to become a liquid. When you put propane into a tank and pressurize it, it becomes a liquid, and when you let it out, it becomes a gas, and it's very useful. Natural gas doesn't do that. You need to refrigerate it in order to put it into a tank and liquefy it. And as a result, you have the ability to compress an enormous amount of energy into a small space. The fact that when you liquefy propane, I don't know the percentages, but let's say you take the BTU energy that you get out of a certain amount of propane and you squish it into a smaller space. Let's say your energy density goes up by 5. With LNG, liquefied natural gas, it goes up much more. There's a problem with that, though. A, it takes energy to cool the natural gas to put it into the container. What you've created in a natural gas container is a bomb of enormous magnitude. Literally, these LNG ships that go around the world with these cryogenic chilled LNG tanks. If you were to, something bad was to happen, the energy released by these things exploding is literally like a nuclear bomb without the fallout. It's wild. Now, if that happens in the middle of the ocean, well, nobody's worried about it. Except I got a son that actually could wind up on that kind of boat. He's on a ship now that does things like naphtha and gasoline and diesel. Same stuff. Wink, wink. I'm going to let it drop a second. These fuels have very interesting characteristics that the general folks don't really consider. I've been forced to not forced, not at all forced. My career has led me into a place where I have come intimately knowledgeable of these things and worked with them in the worst of circumstances. And while natural gas and liquefied natural gas have their place, I would not want to be riding around a car with it. It's also not convenient. Here's the thing. Your vehicle is a tool. It's a utility tool. It needs to work when things are not quite right, like, you know, you had a hurricane or a blackout or a terrorist attack or just a bad day. The thing that makes the vehicles that we drive today so incredibly utilitarian is I can rinse out a milk jug, walk down a block, and get fuel for the vehicle. And while most of us don't do that very often, I've been places and search for situations where that's the difference between putting a community back together and not. New Orleans, after Katrina, 9/11 in New York City. If you can't carry your fuel in a milk jug, it's just it's titanium, it's vaporware, it's silliness. And the thing is, why are we trying to eliminate that? Is it because it's better for the environment? Is it better for control? I have many more things to say, but I'm going to pass it back to Ned for a bit.
Thank you very much. AC2GS, let me make sure I have it. Okay. I think it's the perception that it is better for the environment. And all things being equal, people kind of go along with perceptions of things being better than other things. You know, is gasoline terrible? It used to be more terrible. Back in the good old days, they heightened the effect of octane by using leaded additives that would spray lead in the air that, heavy metals produce mental fogging and such. I just want to touch, maybe it's just because of my chemistry background. Propane is a very simple molecule. It's a hydrocarbon that's made of 3 carbon atoms and 8 hydrogen atoms. And because it has a 3 carbon chain, its boiling point is lower than other types of hydrocarbons. A natural gas is primarily methane. That's a 1 carbon atom and 4 hydrogen atoms. Because of its 1 carbon chain, it's much more volatile and has a higher boiling point. That's why it's relatively easy to liquefy propane, and it's relatively difficult to liquefy mostly the methane that's in natural gas. So the reason why, I guess, people don't call natural gas methane is it's not inherently 100% methane. It's a probable combination of other hydrocarbons, but the primary ingredient in natural gas, my understanding, is methane itself. So I just wanted to get that little detail out there.
And I just have one remark.
Thank you, Roy. Very good additive information.
You're welcome, Jim. Stu, what would you like to say?
Sure. Getting back to Jim's point, Jim and I always seem to think alike. And Jim raised the specter of whether or not this business about the fuels is for the climate or is it control. And I 100% agree with Jim in terms of the issue of control over people, over the fuel. Jim, if you want to elaborate, that's fine, but I'm with you 1,000%.
I would, but in this particular forum, I think there's so many technical points to cover that there's little need to go into the that next level of deciphering the situation. It'll fall into place by those with smarts, and there's a lot of people on this station with smarts.
I would agree with you, Jim. I kind of believe in Henlon's razor. It's an adage that basically says that never attribute to malice what can be adequately explained by stupidity. And once again, I would rather keep that to the political net after midnight if we can at all. There's more than enough technical information that we can exchange and discuss rather than politics. Yes, David.
You know, I was leafing through E-Trade, and I saw a car manufacturer. In less than a year, stocks went up 40%. Go ahead.
Okay, I mean, that's the nature of our capitalist society. If you advertise something that impresses the investor will invest at a higher price. This has been kind of what Elon's been doing for a living for a long, long time. He does not advertise Tesla as a neato car. He tells people that you can actually make a profit by buying them and then using them as a taxi service, using a autopilot piece of software that doesn't work. So you can't. So he lies, but the lie tends to promote the value of the stock. We've talked before, and again, this is not the economic net, but Tesla is priced as a cutting-edge technology stock, doing artificial intelligence and robotics and battery technology and autopiloting software, none of which is real. The battery technology is Panasonic, the robots are nonsense, the artificial intelligence is garbage, and the autopilot doesn't work. But nevertheless, that raises a stock price. At one point, the value cap for Tesla, I think, was approaching $1 trillion. I think it's now down to 250, 260 billion. But that's the nature of the stock market. You're not going to change that.
Roy, can I take it back to the technical?
Yes, please do.
Amen. Thank you. So, 35 some odd years ago, I sat drinking beer with a friend of mine and our wives in his cruddy house in Ronkonkoma. He was a New York City cop. I think that was before I became a fireman. I think the Prius was starting to break out at that point. And I was like, that's stupid. What a stupid car. The Prius is a stupid car. The Prius is a parallel hybrid. And I said, that's just dumb. Now, I'm sure there's a few people out there that are going, you're an idiot. Well, let me explain why. Both, for years, had sails, and then they had propellers driven by inboard engines. And then they had outboard engines. And some nitwit came up with a thing called an outdrive, where it had an inboard engine and an outboard type of system that went through the transom. And the best example of it that I've ever seen or heard was somebody that said it had all the problems of an outboard and all the problems of an inboard and none of the benefits of either one. And that's what a parallel hybrid we've been dealing with throughout these last 35 years we've been dealing with. Jump to automotive technology. The problem with internal combustion engines is that they have a very narrow power band and they require a very strong engine to withstand this reciprocating force of these explosions. And then they require a very complicated, expensive, and heavy transmission to be able to change the power bands from certain RPMs that the engine's happy with to certain RPMs that you're trying to move the vehicle in. So then the gearing of that is very heavy. The axles that reduce that RPM to a different... It's a very heavy, clunky system because of the very narrow power band of an internal combustion engine. The whole electrification of the drivetrain solves all that. And that's great. I'm going to drop.
electric motors especially under modern controls, have an almost unlimited power band, virtually, you know. I'm sure I can be corrected, but the details. I'm not talking about the details. I'm talking about the generalities. But an electric drivetrain is very efficient. But the thing is, carrying electricity with you in your pocket is ridiculously filthy, it's ridiculously dirty, it's ridiculously expensive. It doesn't work. I mean, you can force an example of it working, like these cute little cars running around, but they don't work when things are inconvenient. Whether you have to go to your sister-in-law's 3 states away, or there's a storm, or it's cold, or there's a flood, none of it works. Here's the thing. An electric drivetrain is probably a big improvement over a mechanical drivetrain. Storing energy in a battery today, now someday this may be different, but today it's not, is filthy, expensive, and not practical. I'm going to drop once more. The real answer, not the answer, but a better way to deal with this is something that I've come to learn is called a series hybrid. And that day in my friend's house in Ronkonkoma, he had a new computer, and he wrote down what I said. He said, "I think you're full of crap. I'm going to write it down here on his computer, and we'll see what happens, you know, in the future." The tool that makes this whole thing work is what's called a series hybrid, and it's nothing new. It's kind of the way electric submarines and ships and some military vehicles have been working for 100 years. You got a generator run by an engine that makes electricity. You have a modest-sized battery that works as a buffer, almost as a capacitor, but really not. It's more than that. It's a buffer. And you run the drivetrain on an electric system, which today is amazing how the controls of that can optimize your efficiency. And you can ride to 7-Eleven to get a cup of coffee on electric. You can run to Idaho on the battery, on the engine. And finally, actually there was a car that did that. I got a note here. In 1916, there was an Owens Magnetic Tourer that did that. 1916. We haven't seen it to this day. Well, now there's a Mazda CX-30 REV that probably is not coming to the United States, but it's working that way. And in 2025 is going to be a Ram 1500 Ram Charger. The Ram Charger name is back at the Dodge. Let me let it drop. The point is, moving energy with electricity and moving energy with natural gas is excellent. But storing it and carrying it in electricity and natural gas is both inefficient, filthy, and dangerous. But if you pick the right little selections on the Chinese food menu, and you go with store some electricity, run an electric drivetrain, and a generator that runs on whatever's available. Mazda's doing it with a tiny little rotary engine. Dodge is doing it with their B6. Probably one's too big and one's too small. But finally, there's some people going in the right direction. Because efficiency is excellent. But efficiency without utility is a waste of time. And I could go on and on about the details, but I figured I'd throw that out there for thought. So I'm going to back off here and let the whole world go crazy. Thanks for humoring me. Over to Roy.
AC2GS, you're welcome, Jim. Yeah, I mean, you don't need to go very far. I'm not quite sure if it's Tesla or SpaceX. One of those companies has a train system that they just inaugurated to move a lot of stuff from A to Area B. And you would wonder, you know, would it be all electric? No. The train is electric. The motors are electric, but it has a natural gas-driven generator. So it's being applied, your concept. And I agree with you. It makes a great deal of sense and allows people to get the benefits. Again, though, they can't use the magic word carbon footprint and get away with it, because there's an immediate observation that you're inevitably using some kind of carbon-based fuel to run the electrical motors of the device. So I think that's where it breaks down as far as politicians, investors, consumers who are a little bit crazy and such. But it's a good idea.
Carbon dioxide composition of the atmosphere is about 40 parts per million, maybe a little lower than that. In the past, it was higher than that, a little bit higher. And the plants were the size of, the animals were the size of buildings, and the buildings, and the plants were the size of mountains. Carbon dioxide is the gas of life. This crap about carbon dioxide being some devil is just dead wrong.
Well, I think Chris KD2WOT wanted to say something. So, Chris?
Yeah, I wanted to say I agree with Jim. The superior drivetrain is certainly electric as opposed to the internal combustion engine. You know, when we think of hydrogen-powered vehicles, we're not necessarily thinking of internal combustion engines. There are hydrogen-powered vehicles that are actually electric vehicles, and they use something called a fuel cell that chemically turns hydrogen into electricity to power the engine.
PhD?
Yes, Jim? I just want to point out that changing one form of energy to another at a non-zero loss is part of physics, and so yes, you could always change something into something else at a cost. But Jim, what do you want to say?
I'm very intrigued by the fuel cell thing, and Roy's comment is kind of part parcel of what I wanted to say. I guess where my core impetus in this conversation really is about utility. Literally, the Mazda CX-30 REV and the 2025 Ram 1500 Ramcharger Hybrid are total opposite ends of the spectrum. One's too big, one's too small. Like the three wolves, I forget the tale about the... Anyway, leave it. You know, somebody will pick up and tell me what I'm talking about. The thing is, if your car can run your car can run your house, you can make electric out of whatever fuel is available, you know, this is gasoline. If you were to take a generator on the car, truck, whatever, on the Dodge Ram, 1500 Ram Charger Hybrid, it's a V6 gasoline motor. On the CX-30 REV, it's a very small rotary motor, which is very interesting, because once you take a situation where you take an internal combustion engine, instead of trying to widen its power band all over the place and make everything very heavy and run through heavy transmissions and axles, you just make it run a generator. You can optimize the efficiency. So, to be able to make some electricity out of a bucket of fuel and run your house when the house doesn't have power, or run your car when the car doesn't have power. These are all doable, off-the-shelf hardware these days. Yet they're forcing us into these little niches that don't work. So I'll back up into the tech. Over to Roy.
WA2VDH with comment.
Yeah, John. By the way, Jim, that's Goldilocks and the Three Bears. John?
Yeah, I was just listening. Yeah, a good example of that is the diesel electric locomotive. That
where a diesel engine drives a generator, and then the drivetrain is actually a motor. It's actually an electric motor. And that's been around for quite a while, so it's not new technology or anything. And yeah, I see the speed torque characteristics of a motor, of an electric motor, is ideal for traction. A good example is the old subway cars. They can start. The electric motor will give maximum torque from standstill, whereas a regular gasoline engine, you have to have all the transmission, you have to allow a certain amount of slippage. If you stall the engine, you get zero torque. But an electric motor, if you zero rotation, you can get maximum torque for starting. So it has just the right speed torque characteristics for traction for moving. So go ahead.
Agreed.
Patricia.
Yes, Wesley?
Just a question. How far we are on the schedule to the science section?
We're pretty much down the road. I'm feeling a little bit nervous for Marvin, KC2GZEC, who's also on the list tonight.
Okay.
K2RCC. Anyway. Yes, Chris?
For just really quick question of you guys are talking about propane and natural gas. Why doesn't, or somebody said that propane doesn't work well in the cold. And I do have a barbecue using propane tank, the little tank. That seems to work fine. So I'm just wondering what the problem is with propane in the cold. Maybe that's too small to have the problem or something. And then what's the difference between propane and natural gas as far as BT goes per volume? So if you had the same volume of the gas in a gaseous state of each one, which one has more BTUs in it? Thanks. K2SDP.
Roy, happy to take that or happy to have you take it?
Okay, you can take it, Jim. I just want to remind, I mentioned earlier, the thing with the difference between propane and ultimately methane is that they have two different freezing points. So it's a lot easier to liquefy propane than it is to liquefy methane. But you take it, Jim.
Okay, I'm going to generalize here. It gets quite technical, so I'm going to generalize it that everybody will understand. Propane is not hard to make into a liquid. You compress a little and it goes, oh, okay, I'll be liquid. And it's equally as happy to come back out, but it's very gentle in that whole thing. In weather that's, 20 degrees, like we were talking about earlier, it doesn't want to change from the liquid that's in the tank to a gas. It tends to go, yeah, I'm good here, I'll be a liquid. So it's hard to get it out of the tank and doing your barbecue thing. So it really depends on how many BTUs you want to create out of the propane in the tank. If you have one burner on a barbecue on low, it's happy. If you try to turn the barbecue into an inferno, it's not going to do it. It just doesn't do it. Natural gas, on the other hand, if you put it in a tank, it violently wants to be a gas. It don't want to be liquid in any which way. It's viciously trying to turn itself into a gas. So the propane has more energy per unit, but the natural gas don't want to be liquid. It wants to be a gas violently. So it's more easily turned into heat energy from a storage component. Does that clarify it?
Yes, except for which one has more BTUs in a gaseous state. So if you had one cubic foot, let's say, of each one, which one has more energy in the same volume?
Okay.
Got it. Thank you. Back to Roy. K2SDP.
Okay. When in doubt, ask Google. Google is our friend. Natural gas provides just over 1,000 BTUs per cubic foot. The same volume of propane in gaseous form provides about 2,500 BTUs. So that's what Google has to say on the subject.
An important point.
Sure, Jim.
There's one big difference in the practicality, because that's where I come from when I try to speak, is that when you let propane out of a cylinder and it kind of goes off across the yard versus natural gas out of a cylinder or the pipe from the street, there's a very big behavioral difference that has to do with the specific gravity. Propane is heavier than air and will sink into your basement and collect until it finds an ignition source and blow up your house. Natural gas has a specific gravity lower than air, and it will rise and dissipate. And a lot of the laws have to do with the laws and the customs of how they're used, either in urban or suburban or rural environments, reflect those differences in the chemical and physical properties of those two different materials. So propane will sink into the basement, and if you have a heating unit down there, it'll blow the place up. Natural gas will tend to go up and dissipate and go away. Tend. This doesn't always work that way, but natural gas tends to be safer in your house. But it holds less BTUs per cubic foot of gas.
Okay, very good, Jim. Yeah, Rich?
Just want to ask this question. About 20 years ago, I had a barbecue on, and out of a million to one shot, burning branches ended up on top of the propane tank. It took me about 30 to 45 seconds to use snow to get out the fire that was on top of the propane tank. And I've always wondered, how close was I to utter catastrophe with burning branches on top of a propane tank?
Not close.
Jim, could you explain why?
Roy, how's your time?
Feel free. Unfortunately, I don't know if I'm not even sure if Marvin is listening to us anymore. Sometimes we have people at the end of our list that kind of fade away. So feel free to explain the concept.
Very good. So if you were to heat a propane tank with flame impingement, like you're speaking of, it definitely is a potential problem. A couple branches, not so much. You will probably, the biggest hazard there probably was if you burn through the hose connected to the tank. And then you would, if it burned through the hose, you would have a pretty jet of flames running out of the hose, because the hose is generally rubber. But there's pressure relief valves on the tanks, at the valve, that if you would heat the tank too much, they relieve the pressure. Now granted, if there's a fire there and they relieve the pressure, there's a fire. And if it's right next to your house, that's a problem. But if it's away from the house, it's generally not a problem. It's quite pyrotechnic. It's interesting. It's fun. But it generally isn't too big of a problem. The big thing about when you're dealing with that type of situation is if you can close the valve, the whole problem. If the valve's melted or the knob of the valve is melted, that gets more difficult. But a lot of times it has more to do with what's going on around it. If there's a big fire come out of a propane cylinder and it's in the middle of a field, okay, it's not that big a deal. If it's exposing your house and both the value of your house and the life in the house, or if it's exposing an apartment building with lots the life of the house that's very hard to account for and get everybody out, you know, it gets more complicated very quickly. I don't know if I've addressed the whole question, but back to the question.
But I thought the propane is stored in the tank under tremendous pressure. Am I wrong about that?
It's not tremendous pressure. I forget the pressure. It's not very high at all. I don't remember the pressure. Somebody Google, catch me up on that. But it's not very high. What happens is propane, it's really has to do with its boiling point. If you take a material, a liquid, or a gas, or you take a gas, and if its boiling point is, let's say, 100 degrees, and you cool it to 90 degrees, it becomes a liquid. And propane conveniently has a boiling point that is, in the summertime when you're on your barbecue, quite happy. It transitions from a liquid to a gas. But now, this time of year, if you're trying to make heat out of it, it doesn't want to do that as much. It's like, I'll become a gas in my own leisure. So there's a bunch of different characteristics that you measure in that whole thing. But am I making it any simpler or harder? I'm not sure.
No, you're making it simpler. I was just under the impression for all these 20 years, and especially when this happened, that it was like lighting a fuse on a bomb. Because once in a while you do hear propane tanks exploding and wiping out two houses on a block. I think I've heard of that type of thing happen. I mean, this was so scary for me at the time that after I finally put out the fire on top of the propane tank, I just went inside into my living room and sat on the couch for about 10 minutes staring at the ceiling, thinking that I almost took out my whole family. But you're saying that was a misconception.
Rich,
if the flame and impingement on the tank continued, it gets interesting. You know, had the tank vented when you were, in the direction of the tank vents, because it has a blow-off vent, you might have been incinerated. So I'm not saying you were not in danger. I'm just saying that the process that it goes through is a little more subtle than just everything's falling kaboom.
Let me just throw out some numbers, if I can. Apparently, the internal pressure of a propane tank is somewhere between 100 and 200 pounds per square inch. One atmospheric pressure is about 14 pounds per square inch. So it's not a really heavy-duty, high-pressure environment. It's more of the fire producing heat in the tank. If it's a couple of branches at the top of the tank, most of the heat is going to dissipate upward. It's not going to heat up the tank much. So if you unfortunately had a propane tank sitting in a house on fire, yeah, then it would heat up enough to have the tank explode and give you a gas ball fire. But under the circumstances that you described, I would assume, you know, it's not a good idea to do that, but I think the chances of something freakishly bad happening are rather small.
That's fairly accurate.
All these 20 years later, I finally feel some relief about that incident. I was trying to put it out with snow, and it took me about 30 to 45 seconds. I thought I was going to blow my house up, but I get it, guys. Thanks a lot. WTBZ.
BDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
Yeah, I just happened to Google the engineering toolbox .com. For the heating values of some common gases in BTUs per cubic foot. For methane, it's 1,011 BTUs per cubic foot. For propane, it's 2,572 BTUs per cubic foot. Interesting, for hydrogen, it's 325, and for butane, the stuff they use in little cigarette lighters, 3,225. This is from the engineeringtoolbox.com, heating values